Well, what shall we do this morning? I suppose that the reason that a nice down-to-earth astronaut like me is here in a far-out group like this is somehow to take an experience which man has now had, and let me say to start with that I'd rather devote my energies this morning to what I see as that task rather than to the task of trying to say human instead of man or whatever. And so please, if you wish, interpret man as mankind or humanity or whatever suits you. I really don't mean it in the chauvinist sense. Bill gave you some introduction yesterday as to what my background has been. This morning what I'd like to do is take all of you on that trip with me through that experience, because the experience itself has very little meaning if in fact it is an experience only for an individual or a small group of individuals isolated from the rest of humanity. And so what I want to do this morning is to, just before we started, I was asked whether I had integrated that experience. I think that part of what this morning is all about is that process of integration. And it's not my process, it's our process. And so I want you to face that process this morning. And to do that, we'll have to go back a bit in history. And I don't want to go back too far, but let me just go back to 1969 and paint a picture at that point, and let's start from there. In early 1969, I was preparing for my flight on Apollo 9. Apollo 9 was to be the first flight of the lunar module, the first time that we had taken that spacecraft off the ground, exposed it to that strange environment, and try to see whether it was going to be ready to do the job. The setting was fairly interesting. In December of 1968, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders had circled the moon on Christmas Eve and had read from Genesis and other parts of the Bible in a sense to sacramentalize that experience, and somehow to transmit what they were experiencing to everyone back on Earth, the good green Earth, as Frank called it. And those are people that you know. They're not heroes out of books. They're next door neighbors. Their children and your children play. And they're out there around the moon and reading from the Bible in a way that you know means a great deal to them. And then the next day, in the New York Times Magazine section, comes one of those incredible insights that happens. And Archibald MacLeish writes an essay about the step that humanity has now taken, that somehow things rather suddenly have changed, and that man now no longer sees himself in the same way that he saw himself before. That we see the earth now as it truly is, bright and blue and beautiful in that eternal silence where it floats. And man as riders on the earth together, on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold. Brothers who know now they are truly brothers. And as you're preparing to go up into space yourself, that's a heavy trip. Because you realize that it's not just a physical thing you're doing, but that there's a good bit more to it. And so, in all the other preparation that you make, you somehow incorporate that, a preparation for that experience as well. All this forms the background for that very, very busy foreground. The foreground that involves simulation after simulation, lying on your back in a simulator, sometimes in a spacesuit, sometimes not, looking at the hundreds of dials and switches and controls, going through launch after launch, launch aborts, memorizing all those millions of procedures which are required to save your life and the life of your fellows if you run into this problem or that problem. You spend another 100 hours and more in practicing rendezvous, how to bring two cosmic vehicles together out there in space, which is no simple task. Incredible numbers of meetings, going over procedures and detailed checklists and techniques, mission rules, what we call mission rules, thinking about everything that can possibly happen, everything that can break, can malfunction, can go wrong, and then ahead of time around the conference table debating, arguing, deciding, documenting what you will do in each case so that when the time comes, you don't then in a time-critical life or death situation have to go through that debate, but you carry out what you've already decided. Those are mission rules. Hour after hour in classrooms, you struggle to keep awake while the instructor is leading you through miles and miles of wiring diagrams so that you can understand all the systems that go into that spacecraft that you'll have to fly and will keep you alive or will kill you if you don't know what you're doing. Stabilization and control system, communication system, guidance and navigation, waste management, environmental control, radar, on and on and on, all of those things that are part of that spacecraft. You take part in testing the spacecraft, not a simulated one now, but the real one. And those tests go on and on and on for years ahead of the flight itself for each spacecraft that goes up. You have systems verification tests and integrated system tests and combined integrated systems tests and altitude chamber tests and countdown demonstration tests, and it's on and on until you feel as though the spacecraft is going to be worn out before it ever gets a chance to perform up there where it was designed to work. And then finally comes the morning when you get up pre-dawn. Some people are just starting to come to work. Outside the window, 3 or 4 miles away, and if you've ever seen that, and Bill has seen that, you look out there to the north, and there is this brilliant white object standing vertically on its tail with searchlights playing on it, and it's somehow a white symbol sitting there on the beach, ready for its trip into space, and it's the most awe-inspiring thing you've ever seen. Beautiful. And you go down the hall and have the the last of what seems like an infinite series of physical examinations. You eat breakfast, you go down the hall in the other direction and put on your suit with the help of all those technicians that you've done it 100 times before. And it's exactly the same, except somehow this morning is a little bit different. And you go down the elevator with your 2 friends, and you get in a transfer van, and you go out to the pad, and you go up that tower, and you look out across that countryside, the sea in one direction and the rest of the country in the other direction, and all your friends back there in the launch control center, and you realize that all those years and years of work, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, have gone into that moment. And it's a touching thing. And then you get in the spacecraft and you jostle around and you joke and play up in the white room as you're getting in, and put signs on the back of the guy that helps you get into spacecraft so that everybody on the TV sees this ridiculous sign, you know. All those things. And then you lay there on your back and they close the door and you're right back in the simulator. And you've done it 100 times, and you lay there, and during the countdown you may doze off and catch some sleep, and wake up when you're called on to take a reading or something. And then they count backward down to 0, and off you go. And somehow it's anticlimactic. It's much more exciting from the beach, watching it and seeing all that smoke and fire, and feeling the power in that, in the concentration of energy that's taking those 3 people up into space. But from the beach, you feel that. And it causes your whole soul to oscillate with the throb of that sound. But you inside now, you're going up, and everything looks very much like it does in a simulation. And you've done this 100 times. The only difference is, at least in most cases, the difference is that it's all working correctly. I mean, things aren't going wrong. You know, the dials read what they should read, instead of some joker outside throwing in a problem that, you know, you now have to handle. And so you go into space, you're lying on your back, and you can't really see out until the launch escape tower gets jettisoned partway up, and then your window is clear, and as you pitch over, getting near horizontal, you catch the first glimpse out the window of the Earth from space. That is a beautiful sight. Are you scared in that process? No. And we can talk about that later, but that's the answer. And so you look out the window and you make some comment. Everybody has to make a comment when they see the Earth the first time. And you make your comment, and it's logged, you know, duly noted. And then it's to work, because you don't have time to lollygag and look out the window and sightsee, because you're up there in March of 1969. And the goal is to put a man on the moon and get him back to the Earth before the end of the decade, and that's coming up very fast, and there's an incredible way to go. And so on with the job, and you get up there into orbit, you separate from the booster, you turn around to dock with the lunar module, the first time it's ever been done, the first time the lunar module has flown. And you have a little problem doing that, because a couple of the thrusters got shut off inadvertently during the launch. And you can't understand why you can't control the vehicle. And so there's a moment of panic. You madly go around checking switches, throwing switches, trying anything, until somebody notices a little flag that's the wrong way, and you throw the right switches and you dock. You extract the LEM, and now you have to change orbits. And so you go through all those procedures. You take out the checklist. You read down the list. You leave nothing to memory. Everything is done step at a time. And you change the orbit. You light the main engine of the command module, with a lunar module now on the nose for the first time, and you wonder whether maybe it'll break apart, but it doesn't. You were part of the design. You knew it wouldn't, but now you know really. And so that first night in orbit, you eat, you doff your suits, the pressure suits, stow them under the couches, put them away, climb into the sleeping bag, go to sleep, up the next morning, eat breakfast for what it's worth, don the suits, and now you've got a full day of checkout again, because this time you're making three major maneuvers that next day, and you're testing the system that held together the first time you lit the engine, but now you're not going to just light the engine, you're going to play games. You're going to wiggle the engine on the back to test and stress and strain that tunnel between the command module and the LEM to make sure it will really hold together in cases where it's needed. And so you go out to the edges of the envelope, the design envelope, and see that it really works and holds together. And again, you know it will, but after you've done it, now you really know it did. And so you've had a busy day there, and again, it's eat, doff the suits. You put on the suits because it might have broken apart. It's hard to live in a vacuum. So just in case, you do it that way. But now you have that confidence, and so that night you go to bed with a bit more confidence, and the next morning it's the same process, and you haven't quite gotten enough sleep, but it's up, and hurry up because you're late. And go back to work and eat fast, get the suits on. In fact, eat while you get the suits on. Open up that tunnel, and now you go into the lunar module for the first time. A brand new spacecraft, and no one's been in it before. And it's an amazing sight out the windows of that lunar module, because they're much bigger windows. But again, you know, don't stop. You don't have time for that. And so out with a checklist and down through that day and checking out all those same systems that you know so well from paper, but now you're there, and now you're throwing the switch. You're not just watching on paper what would happen if you did throw that switch. And you check out the guidance and control system, the navigation and the communications and the environmental control system, and on and on and on. And by the end of the day, you're ready for the grand finale of the day, where you're going to actually light up the main engine on the bottom of the lunar module, the one that'll take one of your friends down to the surface of the moon if everything goes right. And you have to demonstrate that that engine will work, and that you can also push both the lunar module and the command module around in case one day that has to be done, little knowing that only the next year that will have to be done to save the lives of three of your friends. And you light off that engine, and it works. And it works just the way it did in the simulator. And you're amazed. You know, it's amazing. But it did. And it's just like it was in the simulator. And so now you go back into command module, and you're a little behind again. And so hurry up and eat and take the suits off and get back to sleep again, because the next day is a big day. And up the next morning and back through the cycle. And today is the day you check out the portable life support system, the backpack that will be used to walk around the surface of the moon and allow people to live and operate and work and observe, to be human in that hostile environment, hostile to man. And so you put on the suit that morning knowing that you're going to go outside. And you get over in the lunar module, and you go through all of those procedures that you've done 100 times on the ground, time after time. But now there's no gravity, and you're floating, and things are so much easier when you're floating. And so you check out the portable life support system, and everything seems to work, and you strap it on your back, and you hook all the hoses and connections and wires and cables and antennas and all those things to your body. And now you transfer from the spacecraft, which has become home to you, and you know it, and your umbilical to that mother is real, and it works, and you've lived on it, and now you sever that and go on to this one that you're carrying on your back. And you let all that precious oxygen flow out the door of the lunar module, and now you're living in your own spaceship, and you go out the door. And outside on the front porch of the LEM, you watch the sunrise over the Pacific. And it's an incredible sight. Beautiful, beautiful sight. But don't look at it because you really don't have time. You see, you've really got to get moving. That flight plan says you're behind again. And you've only got 45 minutes out there to do all those things you have to do. And so you collect the thermal samples and you start taking the photographs. And then a stroke of luck, because across the way in the command module where your friend is standing, also in his spacesuit, taking pictures of you while you take pictures of him, his camera jams. And so now he has to fix that camera. And so we have just a moment to think about what it is we're doing. But then he gets it fixed and off we go again, and you're back inside the spacecraft. And again, you know, you really need to get moving and get everything back together again and get everything taken care of and put away and get the food eaten and the suits off and stowed back to sleep, because the next day is the big test. The next day you have to prove and demonstrate that everything else now has been performing well. You now know that the backpack will support you in case you have to be outside the spacecraft. We've demonstrated that. We know that all the systems work, that the propulsion system works now. And so now the big moment is to prove, in fact, and demonstrate that we can rendezvous, that we can take those two spacecraft and separate them and bring them back together again after 4 or 5 hours and moving off a couple of hundred miles. And one of them doesn't have a heat shield, so that it can't come back without getting back together. And so the next day you go through all that preparation again, and you get in the lunar module, which has now become a friend again, and you go through all the preparation for that rendezvous, and you separate, and it's like taking a ball in your hand, and as you stretch out your arm and your elbow locks, or you get the straight arm, you let go of the ball, and the ball floats away. Except it's a little different, because that's the way it's supposed to work. But instead, and you're on the ball, by the way. It's the other guy who's on the arm. And as that arm stretches out, the fingers don't let the ball go. And so you get to the end of the stroke on the docking mechanism, and it goes clank. And you look back and forth and you say, "What was that?" That wasn't in the simulations. And about the time you're wondering what it was, and maybe discretion is a better part of valor, and you ought to come back in here and start over again, your friend goes clunk and opens up the fingers. And you say, "Well, we'll find out in 5 hours whether it's all okay." And so off you go. And 5 hours later, everything has worked right again. It's been a long 5 hours, and you've gone through a lot of tests, but everything has worked. And here you come, and you're coming back together again. And there's no reunion like that reunion. Not only because it's your heat shield out there, which is the only way to get back home, but because that's your friend over there. Dave Scott is your next door neighbor. But he was never a neighbor like he's a neighbor now. And so you dock and you get back together and you open the tunnel, and there's a reunion that can't be topped. And so you get everything done and you get back into the command module and you're tired, you're absolutely exhausted, you haven't had enough sleep, you haven't had a good meal. In fact, you probably haven't even eaten that day. And you sit there and you've taken off your suit, and now you've got just a piece of that lunar module left sticking on the nose of the command module, and you throw a switch and it's gone. And there's a piece of you that just floats off. It's a machine. So are we. And it goes away, floats off into the distance, having done its job. And now your thoughts turn to things like a shower, you know, and a bed to sleep in, and all those things that you realize you haven't been thinking about for those 5 hectic days that you've just been through. But all that is 5 days away, because the flight plan says now we show that we can go for 10 days. We show that we can do the whole mission, the endurance part. And so for the next 5 days, while you're thinking about a steak and a shower and a bed and all those things, you float around the Earth doing other tests. And now for the first time, you have a chance to look out that window. And you look out at that incredibly beautiful Earth down below. and you reach down into the cabinet alongside the seat and you pull out a world map and you play tour guide. And you set up the little trace on top of the map, which has your orbit traces on it. And you look ahead to where you're going and what countries you're going to be passing over, what sites you're going to see. And while the other guys are busy, you say, hey, 10 minutes, we're going to be over the Mediterranean again. And you might want to look out. And so you look forward to that. And you go around the world, around and around and around, performing these tests. And every hour and a half, you go around the earth. You look down at it. And finally, after 10 days, 151 times around the world, 161 sunrises and sunsets in 10 days, you turn around and you light that main engine again for the last time, and you slow down just enough to graze that womb of the earth, the atmosphere, and down you come into the atmosphere. And as you come back in, you have this, you experience that deceleration, the inverse of what you experienced to get there. And it seems as though you're under an incredible pressure. I mean, you know that you're experiencing at least 4 G's, 4 times the force of gravity, and you say, Jim, what is it now? And he says, 2/10 of a G. They say, oh no. So that by the time you reach 4 or 5 G's, you begin to realize the burden that man has lived under for millions of years. And as you look out the window, you see your heat shield trailing out behind you in little bright particles, you know, flaking off, and glowing, the whole atmosphere behind you glowing, this glowing sheath sort of corkscrewing back up towards space. And finally, you slow down enough where all of the bright light from out the window, the fireball that you've been encapsulated in, has now dissipated, and you're slowing down. You're in fact subsonic. You're coming down into the heavy part of the atmosphere, and there are just a couple of things left, and you cross your fingers, because all through the flight you've been throwing switches and various pyrotechnic devices, explosive devices that have sealed one fluid from another and one portion of the spacecraft from another, and you throw these and the thing goes pop or bang or whatever, depending on where it is, how loud it is. And you've got a couple more of those to go, and those are the ones that control your parachutes. And so you throw the switch for the next to last time, and it goes pop, and the drag chutes come out, and you say, it worked. And you slow down to a couple 100 miles an hour. And then you throw one more switch, and pop, out go the main chutes, and they work. And you realize that the last explosive device, the last switch that you've had to throw, the last surge of electrons through all the wiring has had to work, and it worked. And now that whole thing is behind you. And splash, you're on the surface of the Atlantic. And there are people circling around in helicopters and ships, and you're back in humanity again, and it's an incredible feeling. And what's it all meant? You know, will man now, after that experience, be able to set foot on the moon and return to Earth by 1970? Yes. All of those things have had to work and be proven, have worked and been proven. And you've been a part of it, and you've done a tremendous job. And you realize it, and you realize all the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of things that have had to work, and they worked. And you're that much nearer to meeting that incredible goal of putting man on another planet. Have you opened a door to the future? Have you opened up the change the nature of exploration? Yeah, you've done that. You're not. Man will not step back through that door and close it, except for perhaps short periods of time. You've opened up a new door. And are there any practical benefits from it? Yeah, lots of practical benefits. Ad infinitum. You get tired of talking about them. But they're there, and they make a big difference in the world. And in fact, you're dedicated to them, because they will make that difference. But I think that in some ways that there are other benefits which are more significant. I think that you've played a part in a changing concept of man and what life is all about. A relationship that you have assumed all these years, and not just you, but man, humanity, the whole of history has assumed that relationship to a planet, which has now changed. And you now know that because it's a part of your gut, not a part of your head. And you wonder, you marvel at an Archibald MacLeish somehow knew that. How did he know that? That's a miracle. But up there, you go around every hour and a half, time after time after time, and you wake up, usually in the mornings, and just the way the track of your orbits go, you wake up over the Mideast and over North Africa. And as you eat breakfast, you look out the window as you're going past, and there's the Mediterranean area, Greece, and Rome, and North Africa, and the Sinai, that whole area, and you realize that in one glance that what you're seeing is what was the whole history of man for years, the cradle of civilization. And you think of all that history that you can imagine looking at that scene, and you go around down across North Africa and out over the Indian Ocean and look up at that great subcontinent of India pointed down toward you as you go past it. Ceylon off to the side and Burma, Southeast Asia, out over the Philippines and up across that monstrous Pacific Ocean, vast body of water. You've never realized how big that is before. And you finally come up across the coast of California and you look for those friendly things, Los Angeles and Phoenix and on across El Paso, and there's Houston, there's home, you know. And you look and sure enough, there's the Astrodome. You know, and you identify with that. You know, it's an attachment. Down on across in New Orleans, and then looking down to the south, and there's the whole peninsula of Florida laid out, and all the hundreds of hours you spent flying across that route down in the atmosphere. You know, all that is friendly again, and you go out across the Atlantic Ocean and back across Africa, and you do it again and again and again. And that identity, that you identify with Houston, and then you identify with Los Angeles and Phoenix and New Orleans and everything. And the next thing you recognize in yourself is you're identifying with North Africa. You look forward to that. You anticipate it. And there it is. And that whole process begins to shift of what it is you identify with. When you go around it in an hour and a half, you begin to recognize that your identity is with that whole thing. And that makes a change. And you look down there and you can't imagine how many borders and boundaries you cross again and again and again. And you don't even see them. And that wake-up scene, the year before, there you are, hundreds of people killing each other over some imaginary line that you're not even aware of, that you can't see. And from where you see it, the thing is a whole and it's so beautiful. And you wish you could take one in each hand and say, look, one from each side. Look at it from this perspective. Look at that. What's important? And so, a little later on, when your friends, again, those same neighbors, the person next to you, goes out to the moon, and now he looks back, and he sees the earth not as something big, where he can see the beautiful details, but now he sees the earth as a small thing out there. And now that contrast between that bright blue and white Christmas tree ornament and that black sky, that infinite universe, really comes through. And the size of it, the significance of it, it becomes both things. It becomes so small and so fragile and such a precious little spot in that universe that you can block out with your thumb. And you realize that on that small spot, that little blue and white thing, is everything that means anything to you. All of history and music and poetry and art and war and death and birth and love, tears, joy, games, all of it on that little spot out there that you can cover with your thumb. And you realize that that perspective has, you know, that you've changed, that there's something new there. That relationship is no longer what it was. And then you look back on the time when you were outside on that EVA and those few moments that you had that you could make the time because a camera malfunctioned, that you could make the time and think about what was happening. And you recall standing out there, the spectacle that went before your eyes. Because now you're no longer inside something with a window looking out at a picture, but now you're out there, and what you've got around your head is a goldfish bowl, and there are no limits to it. There are no frames. There are no boundaries. You're really out there over it, floating, going 25,000 miles an hour, ripping through space, vacuum, and there's not a sound. There's a silence, the depth of which you've never experienced before, and that silence contrasts so markedly with the scenery, with what you're seeing, and the speed with which you know you're going intellectually in your head. That contrast, the mix of those two things, is really comes through. And you think about what you're experiencing and why. Do you deserve this fantastic experience? Have you earned this in some way? Are you separated out to be touched by God to have some special experience here that other men cannot have? And you know the answer to that is no. There's nothing that you've done that deserves that, that earned that. It's not a special thing for you. You know very well at that moment, and it comes through to you so powerfully that you're the sensing element for man. You look down and you see all that surface of that globe that you've lived on all this time, and you know all those people down there, and they are like you, they are you, and somehow you represent them. You are up there as the sensing element, that point out on the end. And that's a humbling feeling. It's a feeling that says you have a responsibility. It's not for yourself. You have to somehow, the I that doesn't see does not do justice to the body. That's why it's there. That's why you're out there. And somehow you recognize that you're a piece of this total life and you're out on that forefront and you have to bring that back somehow. And that becomes a rather special responsibility. And it tells you something about your relationship with this thing we call life. And so that's a change. That's something new. And when you come back, there's a difference in that world now. There's a difference in that relationship between you and that planet and you and all those other forms of life on that planet, because you've had that kind of experience and it's a difference. And it's so precious. And all through this, I've used the word you, because it's not me, it's not Dave Scott, it's not Dick Gordon, Pete Conrad, John Glenn, it's you, it's us, it's we, it's life. It's had that experience. And it's not just my problem to integrate, it's not my challenge to integrate, my joy to integrate, it's yours, it's everybody's. And I guess that's really about all I'd like to say, except that, and I don't even know why, but to me it means a lot, and I'd like to sort of close this part of it before David has a chance to come back at me with a poem by E.E. Cummings that's just become a part of me somehow out of all this, and I'm not really sure how. And he says that, "I thank thee, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes." Thank you.